Now, don't spray your aged Hunter Semillon all over the room, but that, did you know the Hunter Valley, it's not the world's best place to grow grapes. How then, you may ask, did it become Australia's longest continuous wine-growing region? Julie McIntyre can help us answer that question. She's a senior lecturer in history at the University of Newcastle. She is co-author, too, of a new book, Hunter Wine. Julie, welcome.
Hello, Jonathan.
Let's be basic, and not everybody's in New South Wales. What are we talking about when we talk about the Hunter Valley?
So the Hunter Valley as a whole area is about 3 million acres. So I've been writing mostly about the colonial period. I'm afraid I don't have a conversion for that. So it's a big area that's surrounded landward by spurs of the Great Dividing Range and then along the coast from Port Stephens down to around Lake Macquarie. But the wine region itself within that space is this is really interesting. Mm. We had to get our heads around this for the book. So that's changed over time. So to begin with, there were about a dozen people who started experimenting, planting small vineyards, and not where vines are focused today, because early colonial settlement was around the rivers. So the space between the Patterson and Williams rivers, which intersect with the Hunter River, is the main area where early vineyards were planted. And then over time, through a series of different events that we discuss in the book, the focus and the extent of vineyards has changed. So it's ebbed and flowed over the last seven generations. And this is why we've really focused on people in that time, because this is the kind of continuous thread that runs through the story of Hunter Wine. So there's not just one exact kind of place that you could go that's covers the historical Hunter Wine region, even though there's a very beautiful region that you can visit today.
Is it just a happy accident that vines were planted out there, or who did it first?
So there's definitely a process here of design. And there isn't one person who starts this process. The way that we understand it is when Britain colonises New South Wales from 1788, there are many, many forms of cultivation that the colonists have in mind, as well as grazing livestock and so on. So there's a manifold plan. One part of that plan is to try and create the vineyards for empire, as it were, that didn't work out in the American colonies. There are no wine grape stocks in England around the time of the First Fleet Voyage, so 1787. But it's really interesting that on the way, there are three ports of call that the First Fleet stops at. So for a week at Tenerife, 4 weeks at Rio de Janeiro, and 4 weeks at the Cape. Now, Tenerife in the Canary Islands has a wine industry, but at that stage, there's no plant stocks that can be collected to take to what will become New South Wales. In Rio de Janeiro, there's wine, but there's no vineyards because there's a Portuguese monopoly on selling wine into that colony. However, when the First Fleet arrives at the Cape of Good Hope, which happens in around December 1787. There's a fellow there called Francis Mason, who's the first botanist sent out into the world from Kew Gardens in London. And he and Arthur Phillip know each other. In fact, Francis Mason was going to join the First Fleet and travel to Botany Bay, but a decision was made that that wouldn't happen. But what seems to have happened is that Mason brokered the purchase by Phillip of what were possibly vine cuttings, but seem more likely to be what we would call rootlings, which is vine cuttings that have then struck some roots and begun to form plants. Mm-hmm. These vine stocks were then loaded onto one of the fleet vessels and carried to first Botany Bay and then unloaded at Port Jackson in Aboriginal land there. And the first vines are planted in the kitchen garden that's established in front of the first government house. So if you stand in the forecourt, truly, there's a really beautiful painting of this that's not in the current book, Hunter Wine and History, but is in a book I published earlier called First Vintage. And in fact, the painting that tells us this is on the cover of that book. So these vines are planted as a kind of border of the walkway as part of a kitchen garden by George Dodd, who's Arthur Phillips' gardener. And there's a couple of grapes from that. Now, I'm going to speed ahead a little bit,
yes,
which is to say that then the way that you plant vineyards is that you take cane cuttings from existing plants, mm-hmm, You can't plant grapes from seeds, or wine grapes definitely from seeds, because the DNA programming in those plants is supposed to make the next plant different.
But presumably when you've got a good vine, you want to keep that going, right?
Absolutely, that's right. And apart from that, when you consider that by the time we get into the early 1790s, the only plants that are available to further the experiment of creating wine growing in Australia is from that original set of plants. Though, as time goes on, many more plants will be imported into New South Wales and elsewhere. But for the moment, if you can imagine, it's about 1790 and there are a few grape plants, they're growing okay. Some of those are then pruned and the cuttings are planted out.
So when do we see the first real vineyard?
And so the first substantial vineyard, specifically for wine, is planted at Parramatta. And there's a wonderful story about a German fellow who, through a particular process of being recruited to be a convict supervisor, but not having the language skills to do that, probably made the first wine that was made in Australia in about 1792 from those vines at Parramatta. And then we've got this wonderful little piece of evidence that suggests that Arthur Phillip took a couple of bottles of this wine back to Europe. And the best description we have of it is that if it's true, if it really was from the colony of New South Wales, is that it was, wait for it, it was a strong red.
Of course.
So,
legend is born. Maybe,
well, that's, there you go. That's right. So that's the beginning of the story. And then it's a few years before some of the experiments that continue around the colony of New South Wales come to the Hunter. So something that's often forgotten is the MacArthur family, particularly William MacArthur, John and Elizabeth's son, are absolutely instrumental in seeding wine growing, but so not in the Hunter. So now if we arrive in the Hunter, there's some early support for emancipists, so convicts who've either finished their sentence or been granted a ticket of leave. There's a program where they're established on small farms in that river area I mentioned, so the Paterson District, the Williams River and so on. These men are given the opportunity to demonstrate whether the Hunter hinterland, that part of the Hunter hinterland, could be a farming district. Now, these fellows are not interested in wine grapes. What it takes is that once it's shown that this experiment can work, lots of experimentation, as you can see, lots of guesswork.
The background to all this experimentation is an indigenous population already there with, as we now know, established agricultural practices.
All through this story, Aboriginal people are coexisting with these people who are experimenting with all forms of crops. And there isn't, in the very early period around the 1811 to 1821, we don't have clear documentation about the extent of violence between Aboriginal people and settlers. But it's later around 1826, 1827, as more settlers come into the area, including the settler capitalists who will drive the early experimentations with wine growing. So having painted all of that picture, what I'm going to say is that
you need
all of that groundwork laid to know that as large acreages of properties were opened up for settler capitalists after the Newcastle penal colonies closed down and moved to Port Macquarie, there are a group of gentlemen, and they are gentlemen in that very English sense.
Yes,
well, that's right. Perhaps not their behaviour, but their social station nonetheless. They arrive in the Hunter and they're a group of these fellows. So there's James Webber from a property called Tocal, and then there are a group of other settlers. These fellows form a Hunter Agricultural Club, and there's this wonderful letter that they send in 1828 to the Botanic Gardens in Sydney, which is run by Charles Fraser, and say, and I'm paraphrasing, may we have some of the grapevines we know are growing in the Botanic Gardens.
So how many varieties are we talking about at this point?
At this stage, there are about 16 varieties of the... Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So there's... Vitis vinifera is the cultivar of the common grape, which includes wine grapes. And there's this beautiful document that's in the Botanic Gardens in Sydney that shows the list of the known cultivars of Vitis vinifera that are growing in the botanic gardens in 1827. So I'm going to confidently presume that when grapevine cuttings were sent by water transport from Sydney up into the Hunter hinterland in 1828, then that list of cultivars that talks about which ones were robust and so on is a fairly good indication of the types of vines. So they include Shiraz at that stage, by the way. And so people like Weber are really important. And then we get an increasing roll call. Some names that are familiar, like George Wyndham, he plants his vines in the early 1830s. In the book, there's also quite a long list of people. And we try and introduce them all, which was interesting, and then show you how they're all connected.
It's a wonderful and rich story. And I'm tremendously grateful for you to taking it right back there to sort of first principles, because that... I mean, for those whose curiosity has been whetted by this conversation, that sort of gets us to almost to the beginning of this story of the Hunter, and that's then picked up in your book. And Julie, it's an extraordinary history, and it's beautifully set down. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Julie McIntyre, she's the co-author of this book, Hunter Wine. It's the story of, precisely those two things, the conjunction of the Hunter Valley and wine. An ancient, almost, old in terms of colonial Australia partnership, continuing to bear fruit. Blueprint here on RN.